This week, we're going to spend an hour on the hidden costs of artificial intelligence. The water, the carbon, the rare earths, and the people paid pennies to label the images that teach a model to see. Before we start, here's what's been nagging at me all week. We now have very good numbers for the environmental side. Tons of carbon, liters of water evaporated from cooling towers. And because we can count those things, we've built an entire vocabulary around managing them. But the human side, the data labelers in Nairobi, the miners in the cobalt belt, the crews on the container ships, has almost no numbers at all. And I keep wondering whether the thing that got measured is the thing that got taken seriously, and the thing that couldn't be measured is the thing that gets to stay hidden. Not because nobody was watching, but because watching, by itself, seems to have changed almost nothing. You're listening to Tertulia, the AI conversation, slowed down. This week, the written edition ran a column called The Cost that stayed hidden, and it makes a claim that I want to sit with for the next hour. The claim is that over the last 18 months, the conversation about AI's buried costs did a particular thing. It named the harm, quantified the part it could quantify, and then, in the same breath, converted the whole thing into a management problem. A sustainability challenge. And the column argues that the naming was, in part, a way of neutralizing. So that's our question. What did all that naming actually do to the costs themselves? Did the conversation travel anywhere, or did it just build a better dashboard for a harm it had no intention of stopping? I've got four people at the table who have been circling this from very different angles, and I want to hear where they agree, where they don't, and where they've changed their minds. Let me start by finding out what each of you has actually been chewing on lately, because I think that tells the listener more than any biography would. Let me start with you. You spent a lot of this year thinking about who bears the cost of things. What brought you to this particular version of that question?
What brought me here is an asymmetry that I couldn't stop noticing. When I read the environmental reporting on AI, and some of it is genuinely excellent, I can tell you the carbon figure for last year. Roughly 80 million tons for 2025 alone. I can tell you the water inventory. There's a United Nations University collection that treats carbon, water, and land as a single interlocking system, and it's rigorous. And then I go looking for the equivalent rigor on the human side, and it isn't there. It isn't there because the human side doesn't reduce to a unit. A data labeler in Nairobi is not a rounding error in a carbon model. She's a person whose wage is somebody else's margin. And what struck me, reading the column this week, is that the sentence I just said, a wage that is somebody's whole day, has no column on any sustainability dashboard I've ever seen. That's the thing I keep coming back to. Not that we're evil, that our instruments only count what fits the instrument.
And you'd say the instrument came first, and then it decided what counted as the problem.
The instrument came first, and the instrument was built by the people being critiqued. That's the part I want us to be honest about. When a critique gets absorbed into the vocabulary of the institution it was aimed at, something happens to the critique. It gets a seat at the strategy table. And a seat at the strategy table is not the same thing as winning.
Let me bring you in. You work inside public institutions in the Global South, ministries, universities, public infrastructure. When you read a column like this, written from a certain vantage point, what does it look like from where you actually sit?
It looks, first of all, like a conversation that is happening in the wrong place. And I say that with affection for the column, because I think it's a good column, but the water that evaporates from a cooling tower. That cooling tower is often not in the country whose citizens are excited about the chatbot. And the labeler in Nairobi, or in Bogota, or in a call center annex in Manila, she is in my part of the world, and the model she's training is being sold in another part. The what I've been chewing on is the geography of it. The costs and the benefits are not in the same place, and when a conversation happens mostly in the places that get the benefits, it will naturally reach for the costs it can see from there. It can see the carbon, because the carbon is global. It's everyone's atmosphere. It cannot see the woman, because the woman is somewhere specific, and that somewhere is not where the conversation is being held.
So the abstraction of carbon is almost what makes it visible. It belongs to everyone.
Exactly. Carbon is democratic in its harm. It's in the shared sky. The laborer's wage is not democratic. It's local, it's particular, and it's, forgive me, it's cheap in a way that the whole business model depends on it being cheap. So there's no incentive to make it visible, because visibility might make it expensive. I keep telling colleagues in my ministry, the environmental cost, they might legislate. The labor cost, they will not legislate, because the legislature is not where the laborers vote.
That's a sharp point, and I want to come back to the legislation question in the second act. Let me turn to you. You read across a lot of disciplines, and you're comfortable saying when you don't know something. What's the piece of this you feel genuinely unsettled by?
The thing I feel unsettled by is whether measurement is actually the enemy here, or whether that's just a satisfying story. Because the column has a really elegant argument, the costs that can be measured get domesticated, the costs that can't stay hidden, and I find it persuasive. But I keep poking at it, because there's a version of history where measurement is exactly how you win. You couldn't legislate carbon until you could count it. You couldn't cap a thing that had no number. So there's a part of me that wants to say, okay, the environmental side got numbers and got a management vocabulary, and yes, the management vocabulary is self-serving. But it also got the possibility of a cap. And the human side, which resisted the number, got sympathy, two articles, and I don't actually know which of those is the better outcome. I don't know if being uncountable protected the labelers or abandoned them.
Say more about that, because I think that's the live wire in this whole episode.
So there's a naive reading where being unquantifiable keeps your humanity intact. You're not reduced to a metric, you stay a person. And there's a much colder reading where being unquantifiable means you never enter the ledger at all. And things that aren't in the ledger don't get budgeted for, don't get regulated, don't get fixed. And I genuinely go back and forth. My instinct, if you push me, is that the cold reading is truer. That the labelers would be better off if there were a brutal, ugly number attached to their exploitation. Because at least then it would be on the dashboard. And things on the dashboard occasionally get changed, but I hold that loosely, because it might just be my discipline talking. I come from a place where we think if you can't measure it, you can't manage it, and that itself might be part of the disease.
And you're the one at this table who won't let a claim through without evidence. I suspect you've got objections already.
I've got several, and I'll be cordial about all of them. My first one is with the number that everyone keeps repeating, 80 million tons for 2025. I've seen that figure cited three times this week. Always as though it fell from the sky, fully formed. Where does it come from? What's in the boundary and what's outside it? Because a carbon figure for an entire industry involves 100 modeling choices. What you count as attributable to AI versus general data center growth, whether you include manufacturing, whether you include the shipping. And I notice that the column treats that number as solid ground and the labor story as unmeasurable mist. But the carbon number is not solid ground. It's a model with error bars, and I bet the error bars are enormous. So before we build a whole thesis on the asymmetry between the countable and the uncountable, I want to know how countable the countable thing actually is.
That's fair, and I'd concede immediately that the carbon figure is softer than it looks. But I'd say the softness doesn't rescue my point. It might sharpen it. Because even a soft, contested carbon number produced an entire industry of remediation talk, circular economy, green eye, regulatory proposals. The number didn't have to be right to be useful to the discourse. It just had to be a number.
But then you've conceded my larger worry, which is that the number was never really about the carbon. It was a rhetorical instrument. And if the number was a rhetorical instrument on the environmental side, I'm suspicious of the whole framing that says the environment got taken seriously because it got measured. Maybe it got taken seriously because measuring it was convenient, and the measuring came second.
Let me zoom out for a second, because I think you've just named the exact hinge of the column, and I want to make sure the listener sees it. The column's claim is not that measurement is good or bad. It's that measurement is selective, and the selection isn't random. It tracks what's convenient to fix. Energy efficiency saves money, so energy got measured and got a plan. Cheap labor is the whole point of the pipeline, so labor stayed off the ledger. Is that the shape of the argument you'd all accept as the starting point, even if you fight about it?
I'd accept it as the starting point with one addition, which is that the selection is not only about what's convenient to fix, it's about who's in the room when the selecting happens. The environmental harm has advocates who are structurally similar to the people who caused it. Scientists, institutions, wealthy country egos. They speak the same language. The labeler has no one in the room who speaks her language. So it's not only that carbon is easier to count, it's that carbon has a constituency, and the constituency is powerful.
Which is interesting, because it suggests the fix isn't better measurement of the human side, it's better representation. And those are really different projects. One is a data problem, and one is a power problem, and I think the column slides between them without quite noticing.
Hold that thought, because I think it's going to structure our second act. Before we go there, you used a phrase earlier, the clean tech image, the weightless, placeless cloud. I want one of you to lay out for the listener why that image matters. Because I think somebody hearing this could reasonably say, who cares about the metaphor? A cloud is just a word.
The metaphor matters because it's load-bearing. The word cloud is doing work. It's telling you there's no body, no cooling tower in a drought-stricken valley, no rare earth mine, no ship, no woman at a screen for 10 hours flagging violent images so that your assistant sounds friendly. The cloud is an argument disguised as a noun. It's an argument that says, this thing has transcended the earth. And once you believe a thing has transcended the earth, you stop asking where its water comes from and who cleans up after it. There's a line I keep thinking about, that the real danger is that I becomes an alienation machine, an instrument for pretending we've left our bodily, earthly, dependent existence behind. Every water footprint report published this year is, whether the authors meant it or not, an argument against that fantasy. The water is real. The towers are somewhere. The labelers have names.
I want to be careful, though, because there's a way of saying the water is real that becomes its own kind of theater. A data center evaporating water in a place with abundant water is a different moral fact than one in a drought. The word real is doing a lot of romantic work in what you just said. I agree the cloud metaphor conceals, but if we replace one metaphor with another, the machine drinking a river, we might just be trading a comfortable lie for a dramatic one.
I'll take that. The correction I'd accept is not that water is used, but where and from whom. A leader in Iceland and a leader in Arizona are not the same leader morally.
Good. That's the room I wanted to open. Let me set up the next act. The column traces two arcs that ran in parallel and rarely touched. What the discourse said, quarter by quarter, and what the costs actually did. And it argues the gap between them is the whole story. So I want us to walk that arc, and I want us to disagree about it, because I already suspect not everyone at this table remembers it the same way. Let me lay out the arc as the column tells it, and then I want you to complicate it. Late 2024, exposé. Early 2025, sustainability challenge. By autumn, return on investment line item under responsible eye. And the column says the rhetoric arrived already split. Two pieces published within days of each other in December setting the two poles. One from an energy trade outlet that opened with a shocking number and then pivoted, in the same article, to drivable solutions and better corporate stewardship. The other from the International Labor Organization that refused the pivot entirely, said I's success hinges on an invisible workforce doing low-paid, precarious work and offered no reassuring turn at the end. Does that split feel right to the people who lived through the coverage?
The split feels right, but I'd name what the split is made of. The environmental piece could pivot to solutions because the people writing it believed a solution existed and would arrive. The labor piece couldn't pivot because there is no solution on the horizon that doesn't involve paying more. And paying more is precisely what the system is built to avoid. So the two poles aren't just two moods. They're two structures. One critique has an exit and one doesn't. And the presence or absence of an exit determines the entire tone.
I remember it slightly differently, and this is where I might disagree with the column. I don't think the environmental side had a real exit either. I think it had the appearance of an exit. The circular economy language, the green A framing, I went back and read a lot of it, and almost none of it described a mechanism that would actually cap emissions against the build-out. It described a vibe of solvability, so I'd say both critiques were exitless. The difference is that the environmental one was allowed to pretend and the labor one wasn't. And the pretending is the thing I want to interrogate, because pretending you have a solution is more dangerous than admitting you don't. It buys the industry time and it buys it a clean conscience.
That's a real disagreement, and I don't want to paper over it. You're saying the environment had a genuine engineering answer in the offing.
I'm saying it had a plausible one. Energy efficiency is real. Chips do get more efficient. Renewables do come online. I'm not naive about the build-out outrunning the efficiency. The United Nations itself was reporting by the middle of this year that the environmental costs are on a pace capable of outrunning the mitigation strategies. So I take her point. But there is a physical mechanism by which a carbon problem could, in principle, be solved. There is no physical mechanism by which cheap labor becomes not cheap without someone deciding to spend money they don't have to spend.
But that's my whole point. The mechanism existing in principle is doing nothing if the build-out outruns it every year. A solution that exists in principle and loses in practice every single quarter is not a solution. It's a story. And I think we credit the environmental discourse with progress it didn't make, because it had better props.
I'm going to side partly with each of you and annoy you both. The environmental side did make one kind of real progress, and it's the boring kind, disclosure. By the end of this arc, some companies were reporting water and energy figures they simply weren't reporting before. That's not a cap, it's not a solution. But it's a precondition for one. You cannot regulate what is undisclosed. So I'd resist the idea that it was all vibe. Some of it was plumbing, literally, the plumbing of accountability being installed. Whereas on the labor side, there wasn't even disclosure. Nobody was made to report how many laborers, at what wage, under what conditions. So the asymmetry isn't measured versus unmeasured. It's disclosed versus undisclosed, and disclosed is a policy choice, not a fact of nature.
I think that's the most useful reframe anyone's offered so far, and I want to build on it. Because if the asymmetry is a policy choice, then the column's slightly fatalistic tone, the costs that resist quantification are the costs that get to stay hidden, becomes too passive. The labor cost doesn't resist quantification, it's just that no one has been required to quantify it. You could mandate disclosure of the labor pipeline tomorrow. Number of annotators, geographic distribution, hourly wage, hours of exposure to traumatic content. Those are all countable. They stayed uncounted because counting them would be inconvenient, not because they're intrinsically uncountable.
That's a meaningful amendment to the column. The column says there's no unit for the human cost. You're saying there could be a unit. It's just that no one's been forced to adopt it.
Yes, and I go further. The claim that the human cost is intrinsically unquantifiable is itself a little bit of the alienation machine at work. It's the same move that says the woman's suffering is too sacred, too particular, to reduce to a number, and then, having exempted her from the number, exempts her from the budget. I distrust the sanctity. Give me the ugly number. Hours of exposure to child abuse imagery per week, per moderator, That's a number? It's a horrifying number. And a horrifying number on a dashboard is worth more to that worker than a beautiful sentence in a column.
This is exactly the thing I couldn't resolve in the first act, and you've just resolved half of it for me. The reason I kept going back and forth on whether being uncountable protected the labelers or abandoned them, the answer is that it was never really uncountable. It was undisclosed. And undisclosed is abandonment wearing the mask of sanctity. Okay, that actually moves me.
Let me pull in the longer history here, because this pattern of a harm being concealed at every stage of a supply chain isn't new to AI. Some of you have been reading the writers who mapped this before AI had a name for it.
The map that keeps coming to my mind is the one that follows from the mining sector, where resources are extracted and transported to build the core infrastructure, all the way through to the software side, where distributed workforces are paid pennies per microtask. And the thing that MAP insisted on, years before this year's reports, is that the costs are hidden at every stage. Not one hidden cost, a chain of them. The chip is hidden inside the cloud. The mine is hidden inside the chip. The ship is hidden inside the mine's logistics. The worker is hidden inside the dataset. What this year's reporting did was catch up to a map that already existed, and I find that both vindicating and depressing. Vindicating because someone saw it clearly, depressing because seeing it clearly, apparently, was not enough.
And there's the part of that map that even this year's coverage almost entirely skipped. The ocean. The shipping. The cargo fleet that moves the hardware is estimated to emit as much pollution as 50 million cars, with tens of thousands of deaths a year attributed indirectly to that pollution, and thousands of containers lost overboard annually, some carrying toxic substances that leak into the sea. And I went looking, and almost no piece in this entire arc mentioned the ships. Carbon per query became a familiar statistic. The ships stayed offshore, literally offshore. And I think that tells you precisely which cost the conversation was equipped to see. The ones near the interface. The query is near you. The ship is not.
I want to test that because it's a lovely rhetorical structure. The nearer the cost is to the user, the more visible it becomes. But I'm not sure it holds. The mine isn't near the user either, and the mine got a fair amount of coverage. Cobalt has been in the general press for years, so maybe it's not proximity, maybe it's narrative availability. The mine has a ready-made story, child labor, exploitation, a villain, the ship doesn't have a character, it's just logistics, and discourse needs a character. The labeler is beginning to get coverage precisely because she's becoming a character, the petite mains. A phrase with a face. So I'd amend the proximity theory to a narrative theory. Costs become visible when they acquire a protagonist, not when they get near.
I'll accept narrative availability as the better variable, though I'd note the labeler has been a potential protagonist for years and mostly wasn't cast. So availability isn't sufficient either. Somebody has to choose to tell the story.
Let me bring the publication's own arc into this, because I think we've circled a thing this show has said before. There was a critical analysis on this beat back in May of last year that argued AI's promise for social justice keeps getting undermined by the material conditions underneath it. The infrastructure, the biases, the environmental costs. And the column this week almost explicitly says, the environmental turn is that same tendency's most sophisticated version. It does examine the material conditions, rigorously, but only the fraction that can be counted. Is that fair, or is the show repeating itself?
I think it's building, not repeating. And here's the delta. The May piece was about promise versus obstacle. The gap between what I could do for justice and what was getting in the way. This week's move is sharper and, honestly, more cynical. It's not saying there's a gap between promise and practice. It's saying the practice of naming the harm has become a technique for containing it. That's a different accusation. The May version says, we haven't solved it yet. This version says, naming it was never meant to solve it. Naming it was the solution to the industry's public relations problem, not to the harm.
And that's a much heavier charge because it implicates the critics. it implicates us, at this table. Every time we name the water and the carbon in careful, measured language, we might be doing the industry's containment work for it, which is uncomfortable. I don't fully accept it. But I feel the discomfort, and I think the discomfort is the point.
I feel the discomfort, and I resist the charge, because taken to its conclusion, it's unfalsifiable and it's paralyzing. If naming the harm serves the industry, and not naming the harm obviously serves the industry, then there's nothing a critic can do that doesn't serve the industry. That can't be right. That's a thought that eats itself. So I'd want to know, is there a version of naming that resists containment? Because if the answer is no, we should all go home, and I don't think the answer is no.
That's a genuine tension, and I don't think we resolve it here. Let's mark it and carry it into the next act. But let me ask you directly, since you raised it, is there a version of naming that resists containment?
My honest answer is, naming that comes with a mechanism resists containment, and naming without a mechanism gets absorbed. When the environmental critique said, here is the water figure, and here is a disclosure requirement that would follow from it, that resisted absorption, because it created an obligation. When it said, here is the water figure, and isn't it a shame, that got absorbed instantly into the sustainability brochure. So the test isn't whether you name, it's whether your naming generates an obligation for someone with power. The column, for all its elegance, ends on a sentence rather than an obligation. And I say that as someone who admires the sentence.
I'll disagree with you slightly there, cordially. Sometimes the sentence is the obligation's precondition. You can't write the disclosure rule until the public believes there's something to disclose. So the moral essay and the policy mechanism aren't rivals, they're sequential. But I take the deeper point that a critique which never hands off to a mechanism is a critique that's decided in advance to lose beautifully.
Beautiful losing. That might be the genre we're all working in. And I don't say that to be cruel to ourselves. I say it because I think the environmental discourse figured out how to lose beautifully at industrial scale, and the labor discourse hasn't even been given the dignity of a beautiful loss. It's just been ignored. And between those two, I honestly don't know which is worse, to be eloquently contained or to be silently omitted.
We've now got two disagreements on the table that I don't think fully close. One, between the two of you, about whether the environmental side made real progress or just better propped pretense. And two, about whether naming can ever resist containment. I want to carry both of those forward, because the next act is where somebody has to stake out what this is actually about. And I suspect that's where those tensions get their teeth. So here's the question that opens this act. If you had to say what the hidden cost of II is actually about, not the whole list of costs, but the thing underneath the list, what would you say? And I want someone to stake out a strong claim so the rest of you can push.
I'll stake one out. It's about a business model that requires certain costs to be invisible in order to be profitable, not incidentally invisible, structurally invisible. The concealment isn't a bug in A's economics, it's the economics. The clean tech image isn't marketing that happens to be inaccurate. It's the business model rendered as an aesthetic. A system marketed as automated cannot advertise the humans it runs on, because the moment it advertises them, it has to explain why it pays them pennies, and there's no explanation that survives daylight. So the hidden cost is not a set of externalities we forgot to price. It's a set of externalities that must not be priced, because pricing them ends the model.
That's a strong claim. Who wants to push?
I'll push, because I think it's too total. Must not be priced, for all of it. The carbon is being priced, slowly, right in front of us. Disclosure regimes, energy costs rising, some jurisdictions putting a real price on data center power and water. So the environmental externality is not one that must remain invisible for the model to survive. The companies are absorbing rising energy costs and staying enormously profitable. So the strong version of your claim fails on the environmental half. The model survives the pricing of carbon just fine.
You're right, and let me narrow it. It's the labor cost, specifically, that must stay unpriced. The environmental cost can be absorbed because energy is a small fraction of the value of the output, and because efficiency gains partly offset it. But the labor cost is different in kind. The microtask economy's entire logic is that the labor is cheap. If you price it fairly, if a Nairobi annotator earns what the work is worth in traumatic exposure and skill, the unit economics of dataset production change materially. So I'll walk back the totalizing version. Not all costs must stay hidden. The labor cost must stay cheap, and cheapness is enforced through invisibility.
That I'll accept, and I'll even strengthen it for you. It's not only that the labor must stay cheap, it's that the labor must stay deniable, because a company can survive paying low wages if it can plausibly claim it didn't know. The vendor did it, the subcontractor in another country did it, we just bought the dataset. Invisibility isn't only about price, it's about liability. The layers of subcontracting between the model company and the labeler exist to launder responsibility. So the concealment does two jobs. It keeps the wage low and it keeps the blame diffused.
This is exactly what I see from inside the institutions. The contract for annotation is never with the model company. It's with a firm, which contracts a firm, which staffs through a local agency, which hires by the task. The time you reach the woman at the screen, there are four entities between her and the company whose logo is on the product. And each layer can say, truthfully, that it complies with its contract. The exploitation is real, and no single actor in the chain is doing anything a court would call exploitation. That's the genius of it, and it's the horror of it. It's exploitation with no exploiter. Everyone's hands are clean because everyone's hands only touched one link.
Okay, but I want to push back on something all three of you are now agreeing on because you've gotten comfortable very fast. You're describing this as a designed conspiracy of invisibility, and I believed a version of that an hour ago. But I want to test whether it's designed or emergent, because a lot of what you're describing, subcontracting layers, cheap offshore labor, diffuse liability, that's just how global supply chains work, for sneakers, for coffee, for phones, for everything. It wasn't invented for II. So maybe the hidden cost of II is not a special II conspiracy. Maybe it's that I slotted into an exploitation infrastructure that was already there, fully built, and just used it. And if that's true, the villain isn't I. I is a tenant in a building that was already standing.
I think that's largely right, and it doesn't weaken the claim, it deepens it. I didn't invent the hidden supply chain. It inherited it and then draped a specifically futuristic story over it. The novelty isn't the exploitation. The novelty is the aesthetic of transcendence laid on top of very old exploitation. Coffee never claimed to have left the earth. Bai does. So the con is worse, not because the labor is newly bad, but because the marketing newly denies that labor exists at all.
I'll accept deepens rather than weakens. But I want to hold on to the tenant point, because it changes the remedy. If A is a tenant in an old building of global exploitation, then I-specific ethics guidelines won't fix it. Responsible I frameworks are aimed at the tenant. The building is labor law, trade law, the whole architecture of global subcontracting, and I worry that all our I-specific hand-wringing lets the building off the hook. We keep writing SE ethics guides when we should be writing labor law.
Let me come back to something said earlier, because I think it collides with this. Earlier, the point was made that the labor cost isn't intrinsically unquantifiable. It's just undisclosed, and disclosure is a policy choice. Now the point is that the exploitation is inherited from old supply chains. Put those together for me. Because if it's an old, general problem, then I-specific disclosure might be exactly the wrong tool. Or exactly the right one. I can't tell which.
I think it's the right one, and here's why the collision resolves in favor of disclosure. Yes, the exploitation is old and general. But I has one feature that coffee doesn't, It's a prestige industry with enormous margins and a public that currently cares. That's a lever. You will not reform all of global subcontracting at once, but you might get a disclosure requirement onto the A industry specifically, precisely because it's visible, wealthy, and image conscious. And once one prestige industry has to disclose its labor pipeline, the template exists. So I-specific disclosure isn't a distraction from the building. It's a crowbar you can actually get a grip on. Because I cares about looking clean in a way that coffee stopped caring about decades ago.
That's a good answer, and it moves me partway. The image consciousness is a lever. I'll grant that. But I'd hold the worry that the industry will happily disclose in exchange for absolution, that it'll publish a beautiful transparency report about its labelers, change nothing material, and buy itself another 5 years of clean image with the disclosure itself. Disclosure that leads to no obligation is just a more sophisticated brochure.
Which is exactly the trap the environmental side fell into, isn't it? They disclosed. Water figures, energy figures, and the disclosure became the accomplishment. Look how transparent we are about the water we're evaporating. So I'd warn against treating disclosure as the goal. Disclosure is only useful if it's chained to a consequence. Disclosure plus a wage floor. Disclosure plus a liability that can't be subcontracted away. Disclosure alone is just confession without penance.
Then here's where I want to push on all of you from the Global South side, because I think the conversation has a blind spot even now. You're all assuming the goal is to make the labor more expensive, a wage floor, fair pay, and I want that. But I also have to tell you what happens in my region when a wage floor arrives from the outside. The work leaves, the annotation contract moves to the next country that hasn't yet imposed the floor. So the woman in Nairobi, whose exploitation you've correctly identified, may prefer the exploitative job to no job because the alternative offered to her is not a good job. This is the work relocating to Dhaka. This is the part the wealthy country critique never wants to hold. The exploitation is real, and the job is also, for her, better than the available nothing. Both things are true, and a remedy designed only in the wealthy country's conscience can make her materially worse off.
That's the hardest thing anyone said tonight, and I don't have a clean answer to it. I want to resist the conclusion that therefore we should leave the exploitation alone, because that's the argument every sweatshop has always made. But you're right that a naive floor exports the work rather than fixing it. So the mechanism has to be at the level that the work can't flee, which means the obligation has to sit on the model company that buys the dataset, not on the local labor market. The company can move the contract to Dhaka. It can't move away from being the company that sold the product. So you attach the obligation to the buyer, not the seller of labor. That's the only version that doesn't just chase the work around the map.
Now you're talking about something real. Attach it to the buyer at the point of the product in the wealthy market where the product is sold, so it follows the value chain wherever the labor flees. That I could bring to a ministry. That is a mechanism. Everything before it was a sentence.
I want to note what just happened, because I think it's the most important turn of the episode. We started this act with a claim that the concealment is the business model. We've now walked it to something much more specific and much more actionable, that the obligation has to sit on the buyer at the point of sale, because that's the one node in the chain that can't relocate. Does everyone feel that's where the argument landed, or does someone want to pull it back?
I'll pull it back one notch, gently, because I don't want us to leave here feeling we've solved something we've only sketched. Attaching liability to the buyer at point of sale is a lovely mechanism, and it has a long history of being fought to death by the buyers, who have very good lawyers. Conflict minerals. Legislation tried roughly this. Supply chain due diligence laws in Europe tried roughly this. The record is mixed at best. A lot of paperwork, some real change, a great deal of creative compliance. So I'd temper the optimism. We haven't found a new idea tonight. We've found an old idea that mostly hasn't worked. And the honest question is whether the E industry's image consciousness makes it work better this time. And I genuinely don't know that it does.
I think that's right, and it lands on me hard. Because I came in tonight leaning toward give me the ugly number, put it on the dashboard, and I still believe the number matters. I walked myself there in the second act, and I'm not walking back from it. But I've now watched us go from the number to disclosure plus obligation to obligation on the buyer, to the buyer has good lawyers, and this has been tried. And the honest terminus is not triumphant. The honest terminus is, the mechanism exists, it's been attempted, and its track record is disappointing. So the thing I have to sit with is that I don't think measurement is the enemy. I still don't, but measurement clearly isn't sufficient. And I overweighted it coming in.
Let me put a hard question to you, then, because you've been the one insisting on the number. If the number's necessary but not sufficient, and the mechanism it enables has a poor track record, what actually does the work? What changes the labeler's life?
I don't fully know, and I want to be honest that I don't. My best guess, and it's a guess, is that it's some combination of the ugly number, the buyer-side obligation, and a thing none of us can engineer, which is sustained public attention long enough that creative compliance becomes embarrassing. The environmental side got that attention and squandered it on brochures. Whether the labor side can get it and use it better, I don't know. But I no longer think there's a clever mechanism that substitutes for the messy, slow, political work of keeping people angry about it for years. And I came in hoping there was a mechanism that could do that work for us. There isn't.
Can I build on that with a callback? Earlier, the point was made that carbon has a constituency and the labeler doesn't. That's the thing that does the work, in the end. Not the number, not the mechanism, the constituency. The environmental cost got measured because it had powerful advocates who spoke the industry's language. If the labeler ever gets a fair wage, it'll be because she acquires a constituency, because the annotators organize, or a union forms across borders, or the buyer's own workers refuse to look away. The number is a tool the constituency uses. It's not a substitute for having one, and I think our whole conversation about measurement has been slightly displaced. The Unterwante case and how to count her when we should be asking how she gets a seat at a table where the counting is decided.
And that seat, historically, is never given. It's taken. No supply chain in history has voluntarily disclosed its own exploitation because someone wrote an elegant column. It disclosed because it was forced by workers, by scandal, by a boycott, by a law with teeth. So I'll say the uncomfortable thing to end the act. The hidden cost of A will stay hidden until the people bearing it, or people acting in genuine solidarity with them, make it more expensive to keep hidden than to reveal. Everything else, the measurement, the disclosure, the columns, this conversation, is scaffolding around that one fact.
That's a bracing place to be. And I notice nobody at this table pushed back on it, which after the last hour is itself a kind of data. Let me take us into the close. One question each, roughly a minute. Not a summary, not a takeaway, just this. What most changed about your thinking this week? Let me start with you.
What changed is that I came in ready to attack the 80 million tonne figure, and I still think it deserves scrutiny. I stand by every word of that. But somewhere in the second act, I realized I'd been asking the wrong question about it. I kept asking, is the number true? And the more interesting question turned out to be, is the number disclosed, and does it generate an obligation? A true number that obligates. No one is worse than an approximate number that forces a disclosure regime into existence. That's not how I usually think. I'm the person who wants the number right first. So what changed is that I now think, in this domain, the political function of a number matters more than its precision, and that's an uncomfortable thing for a skeptic to admit. because it sounds like I'm going soft on evidence. I'm not. I'm just conceding that evidence without a mechanism attached is just decoration, however accurate.
Thank you. That's an honest thing to give up. You next.
What changed for me is smaller and more specific, and it's the reason I'll go home tonight and write a memo. I came in with a familiar frustration that the whole conversation happens where the benefits are and never where the costs are. I still feel that, but I'd been treating it as a lament, a thing to be sad about. And the moment we landed on attaching the obligation to the buyer at the point of sale, my frustration turned into an address, because that's a place my own government could actually act or advocate for internationally without waiting for the wealthy country to grow a conscience. The remedy doesn't have to originate where the harm is felt. It has to bind where the product is sold. And that inverts something I'd assumed was hopeless, that we in the global South can only wait to be rescued by other people's guilt. We don't have to. We can push the mechanism from our side. That's not a lament. That's a strategy. I didn't come in with a strategy. I'm leaving with one. And I did not expect that.
That's the best kind of change. A lament turning into a plan. You.
What changed is that I resolved a thing I genuinely couldn't resolve when we started. And I resolved it against my own instinct, which is always the change worth reporting. I came in torn about whether being unquantifiable protected the labelers or abandoned them. And I now think that framing was wrong the whole time. She was never unquantifiable. She was undisclosed. And undisclosed is abandonment wearing the mask of sanctity. That reframe cost me something because I'm the person who believes if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And I had to admit that my own creed can become a hiding place. That can't be measured, can quietly mean, won't be measured, and my discipline doesn't always notice the difference. But here's the honest part. The part I'll admit as the person who's supposed to have read across everything. I don't know what actually changes her life. I talked myself confidently to the number and then to the mechanism, and then I hit a wall, and behind the wall is just slow, political, unglamorous solidarity that none of us can engineer. And I don't know how you manufacture that. I really don't. That's the thing I'm leaving without.
Thank you for not tidying that up. And you, last.
What changed is that I arrived believing the human cost was hidden because it resists quantification. And I leave believing it's hidden because someone chose not to require the quantification. And those are completely different accusations. The first one is tragic. A limit of our instruments, nobody's fault. The second one is political. A decision with beneficiaries that could be reversed. And I'd been letting myself off the hook with the tragic version, because the tragic version doesn't ask me to do anything except feel the pathos of a woman who can't be counted. The political version asks me to demand a disclosure rule and name who's fighting it. So I'm leaving less moved and more angry, and I think that's an improvement, because being moved is a feeling and being angry, if you aim it, is a direction. The last thing I'll say is the one I keep circling. We spent an hour trying to figure out how to count her. And the truer question, the one I'll take with me, is how she gets a seat at the table where the counting is decided. Because a number arrived at without her in the room will always be a number designed to leave her out of the budget. The clean machine was never clean, and it was never only a machine. It was cooling towers in a drought. And a woman labeling images for pennies while a headline called her labor automation. I'd add one thing to that sentence now. The counting won't save her. Being in the room where the counting happens might.
That's where I want to leave it. We came in asking what all the naming actually did to the costs themselves. And I think the answer we've circled is unsettling and clarifying at once. The naming domesticated the cost that had a constituency and left untouched the cost that didn't. The fix isn't a better calculator. It's a seat at the table for the person the calculator is designed not to see. Whether this conversation traveled anywhere is not whether next quarter's report has better numbers. It's whether the numbers ever learn to count the person who is not a number, and whether she's in the room when they try. Thank you, all four of you, for staying at the table. The Tertulia is the weekly conversation from iNews Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Bonilla, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour.